Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Very glad you stayed with us, even though sometimes the material can be a bit frightening.
Yeah, it's a bit grim, isn't it? We were just chatting between ourselves as to what topic we're going to do
in the next
podcast, and worried we're going down a very grim path. Perhaps we'll lighten it up with some more like Victorian or older. For some reason, we think those are lighter.
I don't think they are, you know. I mean, the Victorians, or indeed even before, had the capacity to do terrible, terrible things. And in a way, even more brutal ways. But I think it's important that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that a lot of people find true crime fascinating, genuinely fascinating. And interestingly, it's often women. Now, I find that quite intriguing. What is it about particularly vicious murder that ladies find interesting?
I've literally never thought about why I like. And also for me, it's not so much the murder as the murder mystery. That is my real thing. It's the detective.
Yes. Yeah, so is it kind of a Poirot or a, you know, who did it? Why did they do it?
Who done it? What done it? Who what did done it?
When,
yeah.
When did they do it?
Yes. Yeah. And I can never work them out. And I've watched, listened, read about a zillion.
Yeah. It's like that old thing about it's, you know, Professor Plum in the conservatory with the lead pipe.
Or it's always the policeman or whatever. Who's your favourite fictional detective?
Actually, that's an interesting question. My favourite fictional detective, well, apart from Sherlock Holmes, who seems to live in a world entirely of his own, my favourite contemporary one is Dave Robichaux.
From your book that you talked about last
time.
Yeah.
But my second favourite, or my equal first favourite, that would be fair, is Harry Bosch. Michael Connelly's Harry Bosch. Ex-LAPD. Absolutely brilliant, brilliant books. I mean, Connelly is spectacularly good. And then he created The Lincoln Lawyer, which is even more extraordinary. And then recently he's created a third fantastic detective, a woman, his first female protagonist. But I mean, Connolly and Burke are for me at the very peak, along with James Ellroy.
Are they troubled?
Harry Bosch isn't really troubled, and neither is Robichaux. Interestingly, troubled detectives, quotes, fictional detectives, are much more an English habit.
So English. Because I was just thinking, my heart really belongs to Poirot. I love him. I love everything about him. Mm. I know every single story, and I'm fine with that. But then I was thinking about which sort of detectives I like. I like Luther. I really like Luther.
Yeah.
I don't even know who wrote Luther, which is just terrible and shameful of me. But I'm a big fan. Have you watched all of Luther? It's on Netflix, by the way.
I have watched all of Luther.
How's your Netflix? You've been watching Fargo, because my Netflix told me that you were.
I'm watching Fargo.
Which I have actually seen. Not the third one.
I've just started the third one last night, which is, as the first two are, is utterly wonderful.
I do love the film as well.
Oh, so do I. How could you not love the film? I mean, Frances McDormand, who probably will get an Oscar for Three Billboards. I hope she does. Richly deserves it. I think the film was so special. It's like No Country for Old Men. It's one of those films that lives in your mind.
Yeah, but that's so clever to them to have made those very successful spin-off TV shows.
Oh.
Because at first I was like, oh, this is going to be awful. I can't bear it, you know, when you know, we find out, hey, they're doing a new series of Mindhunter.
Yeah, I think you told me that, actually.
Did I?
Yeah.
I'm always giving away those industry secrets.
Yes, I have to say I gather them with great interest. It's interesting about detectives. There are a lot of very, very good English ones.
We do the classic ones really well. Well, I mean, we'd say Wilkie Collins. Moonstone, is he the first?
Yeah, it's effectively the
first. He's always seen as the first detective.
The first detective.
I like Poe.
Yes.
And I have a real soft spot for Rebus.
Well, I've had a soft spot for Rebus since he began.
You can't go wrong with Rankin's Rebus series.
No, you
series.
Can't. And Ian himself, I have a copy of one of Rebus' novels signed by Ian saying, I'm glad you like it. And he drew a little hangman on the title page.
And I listen on Radio 4 usually to a lot of read versions of detective stories, play versions or read. Yes. And I like the Rebus ones. They're very dark. There's also one Imelda Staunton does, which is like, I'm sure she's called, it's like Enfield something's, but it isn't that.
Yes.
Yeah, so she's DC. But anyway, terrifying.
Well,
listenable.
The whole concept of Scottish noir, which Rankin was really the forerunner of.
So great. He's so great.
Tartan noir, which is now a very big deal. There are a lot of very good ones, and they were recently reviewed. A couple of really excellent Scottish noir. Something about the granite and the violence.
Oh, the
and
setting
anger.
Of the cities, the setting of the country and the cities in the country is perfect.
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 Well, also the clever thing about the Rankin, of course, was that it captured those two versions, those two sides of the face of Edinburgh, the new
the
town,
Jekyll and Hyde,
where Stevenson wrote.
Yeah,
Jekyll
exactly.
And Hyde. And it's very good because it captures that very, very well. And that prim at one moment, sleazy at the next, that great difference between the two parts of the city. And that's what makes Rankin's Rebus so compelling. It's hot and cold, yin and yang. It's very, very compelling.
Agreed. We should get on to our topic. And
okay.
We've just thought up the name for it, and it's completely slipped out of my head. Right, so we're going to get on to our topic for this week, which is Mark Bridger, the child catcher.
Bridger, of course, is the man who abducted, killed and disposed of the body of 5-year-old April Jones in 2012. It's a disappearance that captured the imagination of the nation. I mean, literally, Sky was there almost from the first moment. Every breath was covered on Rolling News.
Do you think she's a bit like Madeleine McCann, what being small and blonde and all that?
Yes, but although April was a tiny bit younger. She had the added disadvantage of suffering from cerebral palsy, which provoked the Prime Minister, David Cameron, whose son, of course,
died of cerebral palsy,
to make a statement in the House, which even heightened the interest in what on earth had happened to April Jones. He said, if you know anything, please inform the police. And really a very passionate statement. But no one can forget It's like, in, I think the parallel with Madeleine McCann is an excellent one. No one can forget that rather charming, small, blonde-haired, bright-eyed, kind of twinkly look. She had a brother and a sister. Her parents were lived in McInnes in Powys in North Wales. And she was, to all intents and purposes, her brother and sister looked after her very carefully because of her difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
And something about her in those first days of October in 2012 captured the imagination of the nation. And I think it made her abduction, killing and disappearance even more emotional, because I think there were 40 forces involved in the search. They searched for her body for 6 months, but never found it.
Hey London, it's the weekend. And here at Now TV, we take your free time seriously. That's why we've got loads of the latest shows and movies. There's Mr. Incredible, being a stay-at-home dad in Incredibles 2. He's got his work cut out with that monster baby, though. Or The Meg, with Jason Statham and a 70-foot shark. It might make you rethink that beach holiday. So whatever you're in the mood for, Now TV's got you covered. 18-plus month passes auto-renew, terms apply.
Unknown vessel, this is Weyland Yutani, Anchor Point Station. Please respond.
Troop Transport Sulaco, return.
New? The kid bit me!
Don't touch me!
Don't touch her!
Bishop.
Hicks.
Weapons Division intends to develop the alien.
Audible Studios present Alien 3 by William Gibson, starring Michael Biehn and Lance Henriksen.
Bridger was arrested barely 24 hours after she disappeared.
And they still couldn't find it.
But he never would say where she was and what he'd done. But we can come back to that.
Yeah, let's go back. Let's go back to the beginning.
Well, the beginning is something that you and I have talked about here before. We have an apparently upright son, the middle of three, of a policeman, Graham, and his wife, Pamela. But there is something troubled. Maybe it's his father, maybe it's his mother. One can only speculate. But there is no doubt whatever that from a pretty early age, Bridger, who was born in Carshalton in Surrey, perfectly respectable, semi-detached house, then went on to live in a place called Wallington, born in November 1965. On the surface, there should be no reason why he was troubled, but something was going on. A debate, a conversation that we've had before is, where does the nurture play, where does the nature play? What's undeniable is that pretty quickly, and certainly by the time he got to 18, 19, he was a boy or young man who had problems. He went to school in Croydon, South London, or south of London. He got 7, in those days, CSEs, but now GCSEs. He clearly wasn't a fool. But equally, I don't think he could control his nature. And maybe I'm answering my own point there, that was it something in his nature and what he felt. At the age of 19, in 1984, he was convicted of his first offence, which was firearms and theft. He sort of could never settle. He had all sorts of jobs, mechanic, welder, fireman, at one point lifeboatman, which is very unexpected, and he worked in a slaughterhouse. And indeed, at various points, particularly when he moved to Wales in 1990, he worked in the slaughterhouse. His biggest problem of all, obviously, was his relationship with women.
What about his relationship with his mother?
Well,
nothing funny going on there.
It would be mere speculation. There has to be an issue, however, with Bridger's attitude to women, which had some basis, you can't say what it was or where, in his own family. Because he married finally in 1990 and moved to Wales. He has had altogether 6 children with 4 different women, 2 of whom were with his wife in Wales. And what is so extraordinary about this sort of case is that it is so domestic. I suspect, and it's merely a suspicion, that he had a number of girls in his 6 children. I suspect that...
What, you mean he had a number of daughters?
Daughters, yes. Sorry, I should have put that more precisely. But I suspect that he was battling, and I'm not being sympathetic to him, I'm simply saying I suspect that he was battling with a profound sense of having an unnatural relationship with his young daughters.
Because what you're about to lead on to is that he had paedophilic tendencies.
Well, he clearly had an appetite for violence. He was convicted in 1991 of criminal damage and affray. In 1992 of a driving offence, including no insurance. He never seemed to settle down. He was always angry. He had all these different jobs. Women came and gone. They did all sorts of different things. Some liked him, some didn't. He had a long-term relationship with a woman who lived in the Isle of Wight who said, I can't believe he's done this sort of thing. Then we had other ones who said, oh, I always thought he was sinister. But time after time, another woman, as we talked about with Levi Belfield, said, oh, he's fine. I'm down. I'm him. I'll bear his child.
That's funny, isn't it? I don't know. Yeah. Why? I'm very fearful of getting onto the subject of why women date men, so I think we should avoid it like we do normally.
We're going to avoid it. But one of the fathers of one of the female partners who bore him a child said, I always thought he was sinister, but no one would ever listen to me. Because he had a lot of charm. There can be no doubt about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to. They have to. We've talked about this before.
Yeah.
They've all got something that gives them... What's that thing we came up with, the Joanna Dennehy thing, where it was like, you know, whether those men should be, you know, a defensive infatuation, you know, where those people are being charming.
Yeah. The thing about Bridger, though, is he was actually... we're talking about a very small community in North Wales, a tiny village near the River
Dyke. Very close.
Very close. Everybody knew everybody else. He used to go to the pub. He was very popular. He played pool. You know, he was, however, and it must be admitted at once, an alcoholic. I mean, 25 cans of cider would be an average day, probably.
On a day. I actually know someone who was an alcoholic and he wouldn't drink that many cans.
No. Well, Bridget was...
Was he thin then? My friend who was an alcoholic and drank that many cans of Stella a day was like, he shrank into like a tiny...
No, he was quite thin. But the thing about Bridger was that he did have this superficial charm that he would be able, he fitted in, believe me. No one said, oh, that man over there did it.
No, just part of the community.
He was part of the community. And so we now come to Monday, the 1st of October, 2012. He's been convicted of battery and threatening behaviour in 2004. In 2007, he punches a man in the face outside a pub and gets convicted again. No prison sentences here, though. None. So we have a kind of time bomb waiting to go off. He drinks far too much. He watches a lot of violent pornography. He loads his computer with, I'm afraid, violent attacks on children, which was discovered after his arrest. So here we have a man, actually rather plain-faced. He's not distinctive. He's got very short hair. He has slightly dead eyes, but doesn't look like, you know, the figure of the devil. Nevertheless, and it's what makes it so chilling, really. His girlfriend dumps him by text.
I mean, you know, outside of murderous tendencies, it's not that cool.
No. And so he rings his boss that day and says, I can't come to work. I'll get my head round things.
And where is he working at this time?
Don't think he was in the slaughterhouse at that point. Okay. I think he was working as a mechanic. He goes to the pub.
Get my head round it, a.k.a.
Yeah.
Have a few drinks.
He goes back and looks at an awful lot of videos of a 14-year-old daughter of one of his friends, he's loaded up. He then goes, because his daughter is at the school along with April, although she's older than April. One of his daughters. And he goes to the parents' evening.
That day he's been dumped, yes. He goes, gets dumped, go to the pub, looks at pictures of a 14-year-old girl, goes to a parents' evening.
But he only stays about 20 minutes.
Right.
April Jones's parents also go to the parents' evening.
And April Jones is how old?
5.
Same school.
Not a big place, not a lot of schools.
Oh, yes, fair enough.
April has a swimming lesson after school, goes home to the estate where they live, and says she wants to play on her bicycle.
Does he live in the same estate?
No, he lives in a cottage a little bit outside McInnes. She wants to play outside, and the parents are a bit reluctant. But nevertheless, okay. And providing you stay close to the house. And about 7 o'clock that evening, the clocks haven't changed, so it's still a bit of light there. She's on her bike. Now, she knows Bridger, or at least her sister knows Bridger, and Bridger's a familiar enough figure in the area, not unlike Jamie Reynolds and the friends. So he abducts her in his Land Rover Discovery at about 7 o'clock. And she gets into... There is some CCTV, very chilling CCTV, of her getting into the Discovery. And she disappears. At 8:30, the Discovery reappears in the driveway to his cottage. And later at the trial, those missing 60 minutes are much discussed. The parents, April's parents, make an anguished appeal, dial 999, and it's a very, very moving appeal. And a huge search is launched with no success. The following morning...
But they've not, at this point, seen the CCTV footage. Oh, no, they arrest...
We're not quite that far.
She's disappeared.
She's disappeared. That night, darkness falls. It's quite difficult to conduct a... We are talking about...
A full-scale rural search. Yeah.
Rural village. No searchlights. Going to be difficult to do.
Yeah.
Okay, dawn breaks. Light comes. But the police launch a considerable search. Bridger is seen with a black bin bag on the road near his cottage. He said, I was simply getting rid of rubbish. Then a number of the locals say, well, aren't you joining in the search for April? Oh, yes, I am. How's it going? Probably 2 hours, 2.5 hours later, the police get the first sight of the CCTV. and Bridger is arrested. This is now the 2nd of October 2012. 3 days later, the police quite rightly alter it from a missing persons investigation to a murder investigation. And on the 8th of October, Bridger is charged.
And based on, I mean, other than her getting into the car, and I'm not saying you should need more evidence than that, but is there anything else that they don't find any DNA evidence?
At that stage, no. Although when they examine Bridger's house, they find bone fragments, I think 17 bone fragments, which come from a younger person. And they find a little bit of blood evidence.
And how would you... So what? How would you get bone fragments in your house? Well, you'd cut someone up.
I suspect, and this is an awful thing to say, I suspect he hit her a lot and fractured her skull.
Okay.
They were skull fragments.
Basically. Okay, okay.
So Bridger, I think when the police arrived at his front door, he said, I know what you've come about.
So he wasn't trying to... Well, did he plead guilty?
No, he pleaded
not. I bet he didn't.
Yeah. No, he pleaded not guilty. of course he did. Although he said, and I think this is a man now of 46, he said he was... This is when he entered the not guilty plea. I was probably responsible for April's death, but I don't remember it.
Because what? You'd had 25 pints of strong cans of Strongbow?
Yes. He then came up with a series of explanations, none of which convinced the jury. One, which was particularly bizarre, was that he'd inadvertently backed over her, that she was going to climb into the lab, but she was trapped beneath the wheels. And
he didn't just ring an ambulance like any normal person. Oh,
no.
God, how awful is that story about those poor children being hit by that car in Hayes on Friday evening?
Yeah.
Ugh, God, that makes my heart bleed.
Three dead. 2 16 and 1 17.
And they were with their friends of the same age who were uninjured, but it witnessed that. And the person ran away.
Ran away.
Yeah. So who, obviously some people can, but like, who would run over a five-year-old girl and leave her there and take her away and hide her?
But that really is the decisive issue. The disappearance of April's body is probably the single most depraved act, although there were many others. He clearly assaulted her sexually. He clearly killed her, and he then disposed of her body. And there can be no possible excuse for any of those actions. She was a cheerful, smiling, kind little girl who had cerebral palsy. And he was a man addicted to violent pornography. It really does defy belief, but as so often, it's someone in the local community. You know,
it's the thing we've talked about. It's like they walk among us. That's the whole thing, isn't it? It's like that you know, we've talked about this. Whether that means that they, part of the fascination comes from the fact that they can literally be your neighbour.
It is, I'm afraid.
As we've discussed, all people who are evil don't wear horns and a tail.
No, they don't. The trial started in December
2012.
But that was the first hearing. The actual proper trial began in February 2013. And he pleaded not guilty and showed no remorse and came up with another mad excuse about, I can't remember anything. The jury at Mould Crown Court quite rightly didn't believe a single word he said and took less than a day to convict him. And I think it's worth reading a little bit of what the judge, Mr. Justice Griffith Williams, said when he passed sentence. You are a pathological and glib liar. You are a paedophile who has for some time harboured sexual and morbid fantasies about young girls, storing on your laptop not only images of prepubescent and pubescent girls, but foul pornography of the gross sexual abuse of young children. This all came out at the trial, because, of course, the police by this time had found his computer. Griffith Williams did say, I'm not sure that you targeted April specifically, but you were on the prowl for a young girl, which I think is a very good way of putting it. I don't think he said...
He didn't. He wasn't like... Yes, not like Jamie Reynolds. He didn't pick someone out.
I want that one.
He just wanted someone.
And the judge said in his sentencing, April would not have been afraid of you, partly because you have some charm, and she may well have seen you about the estate, and probably because you let her know your son was a friend of her brother. What followed is known only to you, but this much is certain. You abducted her for a sexual purpose and then murdered her and disposed of her body to hide the evidence of your sexual abuse.
I just think that, whatever he did was so depraved that even he knew that, he could never reveal her.
At one point, he was said to have told Charlie Bronson, now Charles Salvador in HMP Wakefield, that he threw her body into the River Dovey. I don't believe that. I don't think the police believe that.
Do you think that, whatever he did to her, he was, in a rage and or drunk or, blind or...
Or both.
Blind by, yeah. And, whatever he did, it, went so far and it was so bad that he was just I can't ever.
But in a way, that's too forgiving, I think. You know, because then I'd accept that rush of blood story. But remember, he's pleaded not guilty. He's probably burnt part of her body in the wood-burning stove in the cottage. He's then dismembered or broken up the rest of it in that black bin bag, which is deposited in various bits of the woods which surround his cottage. We're talking about an isolated part of North Wales. No, that's not just a rush of blood.
No, I know that's not a rush of blood. I mean, the only way I ever can level myself off with anything, really, and this applies from the smallest thing to the biggest thing, is that he still has to sleep at night, and those images are still in his head, and he is aware of what he's done.
But don't you think he likes the images of what he's done? Isn't that the point? How many trophies have been taken? You must remember that.
I don't know if the images of... Well, maybe. I don't know. But you relive the depravity of the point where you've got the joy, right? But then you've got the practicality of the disposal. There's there's two sides to it, aren't there?
Of course. But I don't think that you can say of Bridger that it was an explosion. He lost control. Because if you lose control, you probably have remorse. If you dispose of the body, that's not remorse.
Yeah, you're right.
I'm not. But the judge did say, you know, indications are you burnt at least part of her. And I think he also made a very good point, because at one point in the trial, Bridger burst into tears and started saying, I need to apologise to the parents.
There you go then, that's my point.
Yes, that's why I just agreed with
okay.
you. I'm completely...
That at some point, even... This is the thing, that at some point, even if you are the evilest person on the world, and actually, no, that doesn't work, I was about to say, at that point you become probably very... inured, is that the correct word to it? But if you're him and you've done it once and you've had a stressor and the stressor has pushed you to the point where you've done something depraved, not okay, he hit her, he didn't confess, he didn't tell the truth, he didn't show what he did, but in his head, he still has to have it in his head. And whatever joy he got from it can't be all joy.
And I think that's an admirable sentiment, but I think it would be fair to quote the judge again. To add to that torment, the parents have had to endure the spectacle of your hypocritical sympathy for their loss and your tears flowing not because of any regret for your crimes, but because of your enduring self-pity. Which I think is a very accurate description.
Fair enough.
He felt sorry for himself. And so he did that. But it is an extraordinarily interesting moral point that you raise. Where do those levels, how do they change? Do they change at one moment? Do they change at two? Where is the, what's the balancing?
I don't know. It's funny because I think probably the only reason I feel like that, because that's the only way I can level out how that plays out in my own head. And that applies to just my normal life when I encounter people who I feel are behaving badly. I rely on the fact that at some point they have to look in the mirror and look at themselves and be okay with who they are. And if they behave in such a way, I don't feel that they can be. But of course, the issue is that those people don't feel bad. Otherwise, why would they do it in the first place?
Well, that's true. But you are talking about a man who committed a premeditated crime. He abducted a small girl. He had clearly had some kind of sexual assault on her. He clearly killed her and he disposed of the body so that we've never found it. This is not someone who is, how can I put it, to whom I find it difficult to be sympathetic.
Yeah, I don't mean to be sympathetic either.
No, I know. But I would say too, I mean, he paid a pretty heavy price. I mean, he got to jail and was attacked with within a matter of months.
Yeah, but you can't go to prison and be a nonce, otherwise
no.
You're going to get done in.
One man has said to him, tell me where the body is.
Nonce is probably a very inappropriate word.
Oh, no, it's not.
But in prison terms, that's what you would say, right? Anybody who abducts or hurts children is, you are fair game in prison,
no,
right?
No, I mean, Charlie Bronson said, called him, in his memoirs, a dry nonce and a coward. He was attacked, slashed from temple to throat, 30 stitches, tried to claim compensation, launched an appeal, then withdrew it because he knew perfectly well that it wouldn't work, then said he wanted to move from Wakefield because it was too tough for him. We are talking about a prison.
Well, don't kill children then.
No.
And rape them.
No.
Then you wouldn't be in prison. So.
In the first place.
Yeah.
But I think the point I would like to finish with, really, is it's always the least likely. It's always the most. It's someone you've seen in the pub, or it's someone you've met in the street,
but
or
also
someone
with
who's
those
a fellow
local
parent.
Murder things. That's that whole thing of kind of like, of course, you know, it's usually with an abduction or with a break home. Someone coming into your home and the murder being committed there, you have to know the person. Because if a total stranger came up to a five-year-old girl who she didn't know, her parents, who I'm sure are brilliant and looked after incredibly well, would have taught her that you do not get into cars with people you don't know.
Exactly.
You know, there's a, you know, so you don't let people into your house you don't know. You don't, so it's so often someone you know, someone close, someone in within the community, because that's how they get away with it.
So let's do a cheerful
five. Great, so that's it, guys. There's the child catcher, as we've named
him. That is Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
From Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Yeah. Absolutely terrifying.
Mm.
So Jollier. I'm trying to remember, we talked about all the plays I was going to last week. Three plays, but I went to Beginning, I went to John, and I went to There or Here. I would say that the play that my client Tom Mothersdale is in at the National Theatre right now, if anybody wants to go, at the Dorfman, is really excellent.
There's John.
It's called John. Mm. It's written by Annie Baker. It's a new play. It's a four-hander. And I absolutely loved it.
Wonderful.
I loved every minute of it.
Wonderful, and even though it was long.
Was very long, guys. It's a 3-hour, 20-minute sit. So, take a cushion. But it is just simply the story of a couple going to Gettysburg and staying in a quite unique B&B because the male in the couple is very keen on the Civil War. And that's it. That's all it is. And it sounds like nothing, but it's everything. I thought it
Wonderful.
Was brilliant.
I
would highly recommend.
Well, I'll try and go. I bet I can't get a seat now.
I can get you a seat.
Oh, I'd really like to go.
Well, we could go to a matinee after Saturday lunch one time.
We could. But I've had a kind of... I'm very pleased that we're almost into February, or we are into February, because January seems to have gone on even longer than usual this year.
Saw a thing on Instagram when someone had put a thing saying, like, oh, it feels like the 74th of January.
Yeah, it did. And in the Mail this morning, Sarah Vine, Michael Gove's wife, said this seems to be the longest January ever, except for last year. I mean, it just seems to have gone on and on and on.
I know, but my issue with that is this thing of, like, wishing the year away. I was just talking to a client and he was like, oh, I'm not going to get my visa renewed because I'm not going to be free to work in America for... You don't know this, but if you are an actor, there's a thing that happens in the US every year called pilot season, which happens about this time, end of Jan to the beginning of March, where all the networks and cable stations, they put pilots together, and all the actors try and get jobs in the pilots, and then the pilots all shoot, and if they do well, they get picked up and they go to series, and it all happens within a six-week window. And it's really intense, it's really full on, but my client's not available to work for when the pilot, so there's, anyway. And then he was saying, but I'll do it for next year. And then he said, I'm wishing my year away. I'm already know what I'm doing until kind of mid-March.
I think I know what I'm doing almost the entire year, or so it seems to me.
Oh, yeah, true. When we had a good week, we had a very positive meeting about you potentially doing some stuff for a TV show maybe. So that was good.
Yeah, and I'm working on completed a revision of a novel, and I'm probably going to go on and revise the second one, and you know, there seems to be plenty going on out there, which is wonderful.
It's good. It's a lot more active than it was at the end of last year.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I find most exciting in a way, and is, I never thought I'd ever do a podcast, and it's been incredible fun. I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
You know, and I think I've never thought I would ever even know what it was, but it has been extraordinary fun, and I hope it's not too gloomy.
So that's the thing, guys. Please write to us, tweet us. We're trying to be modern and up to date with things. It's not our strongest suit, but we want to hear from you. And, you know, please do write. We're bloodtiespodcast@gmail.com or bloodtiespodcast@gmail.com. I will learn it for next week. Yeah. Next time. And of course, we forgot as well, I've been forgetting to credit my brother Dan Wansel for the music, and my friend George Lee for our caricature, and our producer Poppy Damon as well.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah. Oh, and so next week we're going to do the Twilight Teenagers. We'll leave that in some suspense. Thank you so much.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.